Economic Development to order. We'll begin as a subcommittee and ask that Mark Long of the Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division come forward, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes Division. I'm just passing out a little quick information about our organization. I appreciate the opportunity to update you on some of the things that we're doing, and I look forward to seeing you, I'm sure, later on in the session as some of the things we're working on over in the House side will, and Senate side will end up over here. Just a couple things about building codes that I think are unique. We are one of only five states in the nation that have what we call a statewide building code, and that means that there's a mini-maxi standard set in Oregon. The standards that we set, the codes that we adopt, building codes, electrical codes, plumbing codes, etc., these codes are carried out, or supposed to be carried out, uniformly throughout the state. They're not amended at the local level. That is the standard. We spend a lot of our time trying to make sure that we adopt good national codes and that they are carried out locally in a consistent way. We also license the subcontractors that work out in the field. We certify inspectors, and we deal with disputes, and we process appeals from contractors that have a problem with a local jurisdiction decision. One of the things, I just want to share some of the program priorities that we have, and then I'd be happy to take any questions. But quickly, in the building code system, the construction industry contributes about $5.5 billion to the economy of the state of Oregon. So often folks ask me, you know, why is there so much interest in a relatively small organization, relatively small agency in building codes? And that's quite a bit of contribution to the economic engine of Oregon. It's above agriculture, below manufacturing. It's about 5% of the overall state's economic condition. Businesses in Oregon spend about $100 million of permit revenue buying building permits in this state in 130 different jurisdictions on an annual basis. And that's just building permits. That's not planning and zoning. That's not environmental review. That's just building permits. So there's a lot of money spent on regulation. There's a lot of money in the system. We help carry that out through 130 different jurisdictions. We work with seven different advisory boards to adopt these standards. And today, in my packet, one of the things that we're most proud of and that we hope that the legislature continues to support is on the back page of my handout is this internet portal that we're working on. Our customers have made it very clear to me that they want consistency, they want good customer service, and they want good compliance or accountability. So one of the things that we're doing to help speed up customer service in the system is creating this one-stop internet portal site. And you can see we've got six participating jurisdictions. And the result of this, I know a lot of people talk about IT projects and whatnot, but this is a state system where we're working with local jurisdictions. And the result of this is contractors in mid-April of this year will be able to go online, buy their building permits, request their inspections, and be able to start work 24/7. And we think that that is an excellent way to try to help customer service in the state, making some of the over-counter types of permits available 24/7. The other thing that this system does is it allows a contractor to buy what we call a minor label permit, but it's really a permit you can use anywhere in the state. Come into our site, pay for it online, we'll mail out the permits within 48 hours. They can take these permits for things such as water heaters and whatnot and use them no matter whether they're working in Medford, Portland, Central Oregon, doesn't matter. They buy them in bulk, buy them ahead of time, these contractors have them available, and they're transferable anywhere in the state. And these are two just kind of program-specific things that we're extremely proud of over the interim that I think is going to help make the system work better. A couple other things I want to point out that a lot of folks aren't aware of. Last session we worked on a package of 700 bills for regulatory streamlining, and this e-project is an outcome of that. One of the other things is what we call rapid approval for large construction projects. Senate Bill 715 gave the state authority to really provide a relief valve to businesses and developers in this state. If they're putting a project in, no matter where they're at, and they need us to take a look at it to make sure it's going to go in quickly from a building codes perspective, that they're going to get the services they need to ramp up in a short period of time, that we're able to provide that. And to just give you some examples, we were working with a company in Northeast Oregon who was looking at expanding their manufacturing facility. It's 30 jobs, but in Milton Freewater, that's a lot of jobs. And we made the commitment that we would be there and do the plan reviews on site in their factory to help them get going. And they decided to stay in Oregon as opposed to going over to Washington to expand their factory. And we're also meeting with, I got a phone call today about a project that may come into Southern Oregon. We're meeting with a lot of different businesses, making sure that folks know that in Oregon, we have a pretty effective system and we have a relief valve. If they're concerned about whether or not their project's going to go through, the state will chip in and we can do the project ourselves, work with local jurisdictions, contract, put a group together. And I just wanted this committee and everybody to know that we're able to commit to businesses that want to expand. It's large industrial types of things or come to Oregon, that we've got a system in place now that can really put us in an attractive place when Oregon's faced with competing, whether it be internationally or regionally and those kinds of things. Other than that, Mr. Chair, I continue. You can see my overview paper. I'm continuing to prioritize and focus on anything that's going to make the system work faster, smarter, better, and cheaper for the contractor. And we're excited about the many changes that we've got going on in building codes and look forward to talking with you with some of the bills we're working on the House side. And I know that some more things will be coming through on the Senate side as well. And I'd be happy to take any questions of anything I covered or the information I passed out. I also just provided you a list of the stakeholders we work with. You can see that there's a diverse group of folks, and we try to make sure that every issue that comes before you or that I deal with goes before these groups of folks, and that if at all possible, we get consensus and broad support for the things that we're working on. So, that said.
Thank you, Mr. Long. I have a question.
Sure.
Since the last legislative session over the last couple of years, has the Building Codes Division, in terms of state using the state inspector process as opposed to the local uh-huh. process, has there been more demands for state inspections or less than in the past?
Now, Mr. Chair, there's really two different things. There's our roles are changing. So for we're the provider of last resort in rural areas of the state, and there has been an increase in the number of jurisdictions and the jurisdictions wanting to provide local inspection control. So as an example, Lane County took over some responsibility from us last year. Douglas County is going to this year, and Crook County. So more and more of my direct service as far as acting like a local building department is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, and that does have an impact on our organization. As far as these other kinds of projects I'm talking about, whether we're working with the Department of Corrections to help make sure the prison facilities they're working on, that they get the same level of interpretation from place to place so that they can save money and go faster, these new businesses or the things in Milton Freewater, that's growing. And that's expanding. I think that's the future of our organization, is that kind of high-level relief valve, being able to go in and help somebody who's having a problem and either use our expertise or our commitment to customer service to make sure it goes through quickly. I can give you some other small examples where you may have watched in some of the papers a while back where the city of Fairview was struggling with some mixed-use housing that they had, some problems that they had up there. We went up there in a consultative role and really helped that building department look at the project in a different way and get that thing going. And so that's the future I see for our organization. It's more of the consultant, relief valve, and providing expertise to kind of get these things going, consistent with the state code.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Long?
I have a question.
Yes.
And I don't know, maybe they're totally remote, but I'm always coming across people who are always complaining about the codes, but getting permits. Now, is getting permits entirely different to build? I mean, they're the same, correct? I mean, you get a permit and then they check to make sure they're meeting the code, or can you?
Sure.
Being a novice in this area?
Well, I'll try, Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson. There's a couple different things. We set the code, so we adopt the code so that the standard's the same, so that if you're doing work in Gresham or Corvallis, you're remodeling your bathroom or whatever you're doing, that you're going to be applied to the same standard. permitting issues are dealt with at a local level, typically in this state. Where we're the provider of last resort, it's typically in rural areas. We have about 2% of the state as far as overall activity. We cover about 9% of the geographic area because it's in eastern Oregon and southwest mm-hmm. Oregon. So permitting problems is something that I was just meeting with a group of remodelers yesterday, that I continually hear folks concerned about potential time delays or possible inconsistencies. You know, I got this permit one day from one place and I went to do the same thing and it was a little bit different. That's why we think part of the future is to connect these jurisdictions together through this portal, so that you go in there and you're buying this, you have the same services available in these six pilot jurisdictions on a certain level of permits. It's the same standards, it's the same process, and we can get you through that a lot faster than going down and waiting in line and those kind of things. And I also think that's why these minor labels that we're now offering, these transferable permits where you can buy them ahead of time and then they're usable anywhere, that speeds the process up. So I hope maybe I didn't answer your question, but there...
Well, it's just that the follow-up... at least in my area, East Multnomah County, the builders are always complaining about delays and working with their local governments. And I was just wondering if you had any jurisdiction over that. Not really.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I have not any on a direct basis, but I'll tell you what. I'm always interested in finding out what some of the problems are, because I act as a conduit and liaison with the local building departments, just meeting with a group of building officials today, talking about a variety of issues. And when Portland went to work on its customer service improvements a couple of years ago, we were there and actually had to change some of the rules to help them provide a greater level of service, and we're willing to do those things. So, do I have any direct responsibility? No, but am I willing to be involved and see if there's a better way to do it, either through an e-permitting system to provide an overlay or to help coordinate and consult and see if there's something that we can do? You bet. I'm also working on changing the standards for how we approve inspectors in this state and how we certify them. That's our technical term. It'd be like licensure for contractors. Really focusing as much on technical requirements as customer service and training, and understanding that there are choices for customers out there, and making sure inspectors know that it isn't just one size fits all. So I'm involved, but not directly, and I hope that helps.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Sure.
Yeah, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mark, for testimony today. You hit on Senate Bill 715, the process there, and you talked about it's, you know, used the word or the term relief valve, I don't know, half a dozen times. What's the cutoff? I mean, you talked about large projects being a relief valve. I mean, is it $50 million projects, $10 million projects?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'll go off the top of my head, so you know how dangerous that can be for a bureaucrat to wing it. But if I remember the bill and I remember the statutes, it is any project that's on the industrial land pre-certification list that we work through economic development and the governor's economic revitalization team. And I think there's a list of, you know, and they're going to tell me I'm wrong, but 30 to 50 to 60 sites that they're working on. So it's projects that would go on those sites. And then I also believe it's projects over 100,000 square feet that would be traded sector types of projects, and there's a specific term for that. And then there's one other criteria, and that's any project that the director of the Department of Economic Development designates as essential to the economy of Oregon. I probably didn't get the exact language right, but you get the gist. Those kinds of projects. So there's basically three criterias, and then any municipal project as well. Okay.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's very helpful. That kind of refreshes our memory as well.
You bet.
And then, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Please.
Another piece of legislation that I was involved in passing, helping to get passed last session, was the moving of manufactured structures from Department of Motor Vehicles, I believe, mm-hmm. to your shop.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how well that's gone and the opportunity? I mean, I think it's effective, not quite there yet, but how's that transition occurred? What kind of bumps in the road have there been? How well is the division able to assimilate that responsibility?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, The project overall, if I could tell you, if I could leave you with one thing, the project itself and the IT effort of taking, just to give a little bit of background, it's transferring the responsibilities of the Department of Motor Vehicles for titling of manufactured housing and putting them over with building codes. The process of the IT system and managing the data and working with the counties and the lenders and the dealers, that's going excellent. It goes into effect May 1st. The bumps in the road for our organization, I talked to you about the things that I'm doing related to economic development and building codes, and I got to be honest with you, understanding perfecting security interests and how to deal with abandoned property and moved homes is something our organization wasn't familiar with before last session. We're probably a lot better along, and I wouldn't be truthful to tell you that I'm a little bit nervous when May 1st will be fine. May 2nd is when I'm going to be a little bit nervous about some of the complex questions that our organization is trying to get our arms around. So we're going to be up and ready. Our forms are going well. Our processes, we put the best team of individuals we have in the organization on this project. And I just sat down with some of the county representatives last week, and they're very excited about the flexibility of the program and the interconnection and storage of the data. Some of the technical pieces continue to concern me only because of our just ability to kind of grapple with many years of issues that we just don't have familiarity with. So,
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
thank you. I'd just be curious, you know, if you could keep me informed as that process moves forward. You know, if there's tweaks that we need to make, please, you know, I'll be willing to work with you in the industry if necessary to make that process work.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, Senator Starr. I just sat down with the counties and just got an email before I got over here. There's a list of, they're not oh my gods, but they're things that we didn't think about that we're going to need to get worked on. Just some things that didn't make any sense. And that happens when you do something like that. And I think that we're going to need to do a little bit of cleanup. So I appreciate that. And you can help me with that.
Any questions? Well, leave it to some county folks to get excited, as you said, about storing data. Thank you very much, Mr. Long. We look forward to working with you. We're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 116. Call Joel Ariel forward, please. Welcome.
Welcome. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
And before you begin, I want to tell the committee I was in Chicago in July for a national conference of insurance legislators, only to discover that Mr. Ariel there is like the guru of the regarded in our country for administrators of insurance, and like he's a big mucky muck, and I never knew that, and so now I know that. So we knew you always did great work, but it's nice that your colleagues around the country recognize that. So with that, go ahead.
So a guru and a mucky muck. Those are
it's always a mixed bag in politics.
Thank you for those comments, Mr. Chair. I'm here today to request your support for Senate Bill 116. This is a bill that will enable the department to respond more readily to business demand for commercial liability insurance at times when certain lines of insurance are experiencing availability and affordability problems. Insurers refer to periods when insurance is hard to find or overly expensive as hard market situations. These situations tend to be cyclical and affect some lines of insurance more than others for a variety of reasons, usually including specific claims experience within the relevant line. Oregon has experienced three hard markets over the last three decades. I should note these usually hard markets in Oregon are hard markets nationally as well. Our three hard markets have been the mid-70s, the late 80s, and then again earlier in this decade. While property and casualty markets are generally improving today, predictions go as the forecasters say they will, 2004 will be the best year in property and casualty insurance since 1978. And if it weren't for those hurricanes in Florida this summer, it would probably be the best year since my birth year, 1953. So things are improving nationally, and they're improving here in Oregon. But the three Oregon markets that were hardest hit this decade, medical malpractice, contractor liability, and adult foster care, all continue to exhibit problems. Rates have skyrocketed in each of these markets, and certain types of doctors, contractors, and foster care providers have had difficulty finding adequate coverage. The legislature has taken some corrective actions. The Rural Doctor Subsidy Program in medical malpractice, the bill last session that promoted settlement of construction defect claims. You have a bill today on mandatory arbitration within that line of insurance. There are a number of actions that have been taken, but the involved parties, as I'm sure you're well aware, have not been fully satisfied yet, and some of those parties have suggested that insurers could help more through better risk spreading. That's where these tools that we're talking about today come in. In response to earlier hard markets, the legislature has passed laws giving the insurance division two tools to better promote risk spreading in troubled markets: market assistance plans, or MAPs, and joint underwriting associations, or JUAs. A MAP, or market assistance plan, I'm going to try to stay away from the acronyms because I don't want to be attacked here.
Okay.
A market assistance plan is a clearinghouse that assists insurance purchasers by connecting them to insurance producers who help them find insurance. A joint underwriting association is a mechanism that requires designated casualty insurers, we're talking just property and casualty now, and casualty insurers, to share responsibility for designated commercial liability risks on an assigned risk basis or through a joint underwriting pool. So an important distinction here is that a market assistance plan is a voluntary type of arrangement. It doesn't require any insurer to insure any risk that they didn't intend to insure. Otherwise, it is simply a mechanism for bringing people together to communicate about what kinds of options are available in the marketplace. And insofar as it's communication problems that are at the heart of a particular market's trouble, a market assistance plan can help with that. These days, that basically means market assistance plans are web-based communication vehicles, and I'll talk about the one in contractor liability in a couple of minutes. A joint underwriting association, on the other hand, is a more aggressive form of regulation. It does require insurers who would not otherwise be involved in particular types of risks to join the party and share some of that risk. And so it is used when you have a market problem and you think that particular market doesn't have the wherewithal to solve its own problems, and you bring some other people in. Never a happy situation for the people you bring in, but that's what's involved in a joint underwriting association. Purpose of Senate Bill 160 is to update the statutes as pertain to market assistance plans and joint underwriting associations. These, again, are in current statute, but the statutes are cumbersome enough that only one market assistance plan has been created since the law's enactment in 1987, and a joint underwriting association has never been created under Oregon law. The one market assistance plan was established in August 2004 for construction contractors. It has significantly reduced the number of calls the insurance division receives from contractors. We were getting as many as 200 plus calls a month back in the late part of the last session in May and June of 2003. Today, after the creation of the program, we're getting less than 40 calls per month. But it did take us more than a year to put that map in place, and at least part of that problem was the authorizing statute did not provide a clear and simple process for how to establish a market assistance plan. Here's the setup under current law. The department holds a public hearing to consider the need for a map. Then if the department determines that the need is present, the department adopts a rule requiring authorized insurers to form a map, and then we wait for their work product. And finally, once they provide that work product, the plan of operations prepared by them being the authorized insurers, eligible surplus lines insurers, and insurance producers, must be approved by the department. So there's three steps there, and in developing the contractor map, the most confusing part of the statutory scheme was sorting out the department and the industry's respective duties. With each side, it was kind of a bit of who's on first. We have meetings, and we'd say, it's your job now to produce a plan, and they'd say, well, you got to tell us what you want in the plan before we can produce a plan, and it kind of went back back and forth in that way for several months on the market assistance plan. Senate Bill 116 would streamline this process by allowing the department to prepare a plan of operations for a market assistance plan after consulting with authorized insurers, eligible surplus lines insurers, and insurance producers. Senate Bill 116 also clarifies that market assistance plans can be created for one or more subclasses of commercial liability insurance, since, as we learned from the contractor plan, problems tend to be focused in particular subclasses and not necessarily across a broad class. In other words, it's not all contractors that are having trouble these days. It's particular subclasses. So, again, because the market assistance plan is basically a voluntary deal where the insurers that have plan policies to offer get better connected with those who want them, this is a pretty streamlined process that we can consult and then create a market assistance plan in the future. On joint underwriting associations, current law is even more cumbersome, including the requirement that a joint underwriting association cannot be created until a market assistance plan has been allowed to operate for, quote, a reasonable time. While it is appropriate to require more process for a joint underwriting association, since, again, it does require insurers to assume risks that they wouldn't otherwise assume, it does not make sense to require a market assistance plan as a precondition in cases where there aren't any willing insurers. You can imagine a market where you just know from the get-go there aren't the willing insurers. To create a market assistance plan then would accomplish nothing. In addition, joint underwriting associations under current law can only be created to deal with availability problems, meaning that a joint underwriting association could never be created where premium increases effectively close down a market. And we all know that at certain level of price, the high price is equivalent to an availability problem. But the statutes right now wouldn't allow a joint underwriting association on an affordability issue. In this context, it is not surprising that no joint underwriting associations have been created. Senate Bill 116 allows the department to order formation of a joint underwriting association for specified kinds of commercial liability insurance after a public hearing, so there is a hearing here, and findings that certain businesses exist in Oregon for which one or more kinds of commercial liability insurance are unavailable or unaffordable. Senate Bill 116 also allows the department to form joint underwriting associations that best meet the needs of a specific market by enabling the department to designate which subclasses of commercial liability insurance will be included. We offer amendments today that further, these are, I understand, still in legislative council and will be for another couple weeks, but we have amendments in that will further clarify the department's ability to define participation in joint underwriting associations and require that the rates for joint underwriting associations be actuarially sound on the basis of Oregon experience. This is an important part of our amendment. We, in the original bill,
Mr. Ariel, the dash one, are those your amendments?
They must be. I have not seen them then, but I'm happy that we have them.
They seem to follow what you're talking about. So,
okay, yes,
we have them.
I'm quite certain that they would be our amendments. I don't know of others. Is there, can I, by chance, see a copy? I can refer to you on what this stuff is.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, committee members, actually, it did come from the insurance division. I work with my reporter in the development of them.
Yes, good. So it's line six there that we restore the test of actuarial soundness. It's very important from the insurers. You'll hear from the insurers today that with the original bill, untethered to actuarial soundness, could be kind of anything goes, but that we've now tied it back to actuarially sound rates. But we have broadened the ability to take into account a broader range of Oregon experience in order to have the breadth of experience to actually feasibly form a joint underwriting association.
Mm-hmm.
Even with these amendments, particularly the language about actuarial soundness, you will hear from the insurers today that in joint underwriting associations are never a good thing. And while it is true that joint underwriting associations are never a good first option, they can sometimes be the best available option for insuring coverage in a troubled market. We're never dealing with a situation where there are good alternatives when it comes to a joint underwriting association. We're dealing with decisions between bad and worse. And in certain circumstances, the joint underwriting association is the better alternative. A couple examples. New Hampshire and Nevada have both created joint underwriting associations. Nevada gives it a different name, but it has the indicia of a joint underwriting association to address crises in their medical malpractice markets. And Nevada or New Hampshire has had that joint underwriting association in place since the 1970s. It's had some ups and downs. There were some problems with it in the 1980s, but they righted that ship, and today it's 30% of the medical malpractice market, and the New Hampshire regulators would report that it's an important part of the stability in that medical malpractice market. In Nevada, they created their group, and it's got a different name. I'm not blanking on it right now, but it's essentially a joint underwriting association. It's created in this decade to deal with their crises in medical malpractice, and it has the ability to assess the casualty insurance market, which is not involved in medical malpractice, so the other players in casualty insurance, up to 5% if necessary to make it work. It hasn't had to do that assessment yet, but that's how it works, and it's now the second largest medical mal carrier in Nevada. So it's a couple examples of where joint underwriting associations have worked. I won't pretend to you that this is a tool we'd go to often, or maybe we wouldn't ever have to go to it, but it's a tool that we would want available in really difficult situations. While we are still pursuing various other options for our troubled markets, and you're going to hear about one of those bills, Senate Bill 463 today, on the contractor market and mandatory arbitration. If those options don't work, our ability to address intractable problems would be enhanced if creation of a joint underwriting association was available to us as a regulatory option. You will hear from people today, I think, that we have made some inroads in the contractor market. We've worked hard at this, and so have a lot of other folks with our market assistance plan, but I think you're also going to hear from some businesses today that much more needs to be done, and that if all else fails, a joint underwriting association might be the best option. I respectfully request the committee's support for Senate Bill 116 and our amendments to the bill, the dash ones now, and that the bill as amended be sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ariel. Questions from the committee?
Just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you cite just an example of when a joint underwriting, association would be used? I mean, cite an example to make it more real for me.
Okay, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I think contractor liability will be the example you may hear some people talk about today. If the problems in that market continue to be difficult, and it probably won't be the whole market, it'll be certain specialties within contractor liability that continue to have, these things never happen by pure chance. There are real claims issues in that line of insurance, and if those issues continue to drive premiums higher and make it more and more difficult for people to have that kind of insurance, and eventually, you know, we get to a point where we can't do the kind of building that we need to do to keep our economy moving along, then we would look at a joint underwriting association as one way to deal with that situation. Probably the marketplace that we'd be targeting would be relatively small in premium volume, maybe, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars or something. So you look at the overall casualty industry is probably, I don't know, $3 or $4 billion industry in Oregon, and you probably wouldn't reach to all of that market, but you'd reach to a broader part of that market and ask those insurers to take part of the load to make this particular marketplace work. And so essentially what you're doing is what insurance is about. You're spreading the risk more broadly. This market can't take the risk, so we'll spread it more broadly. Now, of course, people have to get that, who are asked to share the pain. They don't particularly like it, but they may pay a little bit more in order to have a home building industry in the state.
That was a follow-up. That was one of when I was door knocking during my last campaign. Three different people in construction or building industry told me that was the most difficult thing. They could not get liability. And so you're saying this will solve that problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I'm saying it could help solve the problem. Again, I don't want to pretend that a JUA, Joint Underwriting Association, is the panacea. It's going to solve all the problems. But at a time when people may not be able to get insurance any other way, it may be the best alternative to get insurance to people that need insurance.
And who participates, follow-up? Who would be the underwriters? I mean, what kind of entities would do that? Banks or...
Senator Metzger, Mr. Chairman, Senator Montes Anderson. Continue to be the insurance companies. There would be presumably some insurance companies in that market. They would continue to write the risk, and there would be some premium, but insofar as there needed to be assistance to the market, there may be some kind of typically there would be an assessment process against a larger group of insurers who would share in the risk. If we can go back to the Nevada example, they have this entity created. It's a state insurance company. It could be that way if there were no private insurers around that would continue to provide the insurance, and then to the extent there needed to be some kind of premium support, there would be the ability to assess a broader group of insurers. And of course, insurers wouldn't be paying this themselves. They would be a pass-through mechanism to have it paid for by their policyholders in whatever lines were assessed. So it's essentially a way to spread risk more broadly. So you'd be asking maybe other contractors, maybe people in other commercial lines to help through an assessment process make this line of insurance viable.
Why would insurance companies want to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, I have the distinct feeling that you're going to hear today that they would not like to do that.
Okay.
This would have to be your decision to make them, to give us the power to make them do it. Again, you wouldn't be authorizing the creation of one of these. You would simply be giving us the power to do it. But right now, the statute's the way they're worded. We have on paper the authority to do this, but in fact, there's no feasible way that we could do it in any of the real-world situations we face, because the statute includes enough impediments that the process just can't work. So, but you will hear plenty from the insurers today about their view of the joint underwriting associations.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Senator Starr in a second, but I'm going to ask one question in light of Senator Montes and Anderson's questions. Maybe you can give us a very brief synopsis of comparing the joint underwriting association language that you have in this legislation and with the amendments to the providing of workers' comp insurance that we currently do, which is required, and in those situations where people have difficulty getting it, and maybe some comparison between how that works compared to these other types of markets that we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, very, very good question. There are assigned risk pools in workers' compensation for people who cannot get insurance, and broaden that even in homeowner insurance. There's something called the Oregon Fair Plan. There are what we call an insurance residual markets in some of those basic lines of insurance for lines where insurance is mandatory and you have to have some options. And so the assigned risk pool in this state is managed by the two largest carriers, Safe and Liberty Northwest. In that particular case, it's been basically a self-funded program where the premium that is collected there support the program. But it would be that kind of structure if at some point the cost of claims in the assigned risk pool got too high to be feasible for the businesses in that pool to carry, then the same kind of concept could come in of all other insurers in the workers' comp line or some broader set of lines maybe asked to kick in a little bit more to subsidize the premiums. So there's all these things, kind of, you know, the subsidy program that we now have, where Safe's kicking in money to support that line. These are just different ways of saying this line can't afford its costs, and so we're going to spread the pain to a broader group of people. And insurance companies are in the business of risk spreading. They don't like it, but they tend to be the place to go if you're trying to develop a risk spreading mechanism.
Thank you, Senator Stark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Ario, for your testimony today. It's not very often that I have a muckety-muck and a guru sitting before us. And after Senator Montes Anderson's question, it just reminds me of the wonderful world between the regulator and the regulated that we're faced with in dealing with this issue. And it's interesting. As you know, somebody who deals with lots of subjects, to try to have a new one kind of laid under your feet and the opportunity to understand it from two perspectives or possibly more than two perspectives. So I appreciate this. I've got a couple of questions. I appreciate you coming and to my office, and we talked a little bit, but some additional questions have come up, and I appreciate your indulgence. In the map that was created in 2004, you held you created that according to the statute we have in the books today, which required a public hearing. In that process, did you find that the public hearing was a valuable exercise for the department?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, yes, I think that public hearings, when we do them, always serve a useful purpose. I'm continually amazed about issues that I think are very clear-cut, and then there's a public hearing, and you learn something new.
And if I can just follow, Mr. Chair. And then after that hearing, you put together a work group of the industry, I assume. And in that process, was there resistance from the insurance carriers to that process? I'm trying to see why is the current, at least in the creation of that particular map, what was the underlying problem that forces us or brings us to the need for change in how that process was put together?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, excellent question. It could have been done more quickly. It did take us several more months, in my view, than it needed to, because in some of the early meetings, I think these were right after the public hearing, this notion of, you know, the industry is supposed to propose a plan to us, and then we decide whether we like the plan, kind of creates a back-and-forth game of who's on first. And so we'd sit down and we'd say, okay, well, we're looking for a plan from you. And people were willing to come to the meetings. There was very much, you know, good faith participation by the producers and by the insurers. But we'd say, it's up to you guys to propose a plan. And they'd say, well, what do you think about these three questions? And we'd say, well, that's part of what you guys need to figure out to propose to us. So that's what the statute says you guys do. And they said, yeah, but you have to approve it eventually. So tell us what you want us to do so it'll get approved. And we go back and forth. And in this bill, all we're proposing is, we didn't dispense with all that. Since market assistance plans don't require anybody to do anything, they're pretty easy today with web pages. We now know how to do it. We've learned it through the contractor issues, that if we saw a hard market, that we could much more quickly pull some people together, does state consultation, and find out whether there really is an issue of there are people over here who have insurance and there are people over here who need it, and these two groups don't know about each other. That's the predicate you need to make this work. That was true of contractor liability. The agents who knew a lot about what was available said that there were a lot of people out there who weren't coming to them. They were maybe going to other agents who didn't know enough about the market, and they needed a way to connect, and that was the web page. Well, all of that, I mean, yeah, if you did a public hearing and you had more discussions and they proposed a plan first and then we reviewed it and made changes or whatever, it can work that way, and this map worked. And frankly, I did tell the industry, they said, well, why should we do this? Because you guys are going to change the statute next time. And I said, well, your best case against us will be if you make this map work, then you can come in and say we don't need the bill. So I'm sure that's what they'll say today. But I still think it would have happened easier and better if we had these provisions. And I think the map has proven to be effective. So a streamlined version of this would be better from our perspective.
Just to follow up on, Mr. Chair. In that process, the folks trying to get the insurance, what role did they play, the contractors? Were they the ones, was there pressure being, you know, exerted by that or by that industry, say, hey, we got a real problem, you guys get your act together and figure this thing out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, absolutely. The public hearing was essentially a vetting of the problems that contractors were having in the market. I think it served the purpose of educating all of us, not just us as regulators, but also the industry, to the depth of you know, frustration and also, frankly, that, you know, we're talking about business situations, so we're not talking about people come forward and think, well, why can't I get all this insurance for free? We have people who understand business, mm-hmm. and say, you know, so they understood the claims issues and all that, but they still needed some kind of assistance. And I think a lot of people learned a lot from the different discussions that went on that day. But they were very involved at that level. Then when we got into the technicalities of putting it together, that was more the producers in particular who knew the markets that took the lead.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. The question that I'm grappling with just a little bit is this idea that you would create even the lesser version, the map over the JUA, without a public hearing, recognizing that kind of the Oregon model, whether you're a city council or the legislator or an agency that's adopting a new rule, is this a public process, the opportunity to kind of get issues kind of laid on the table in a public forum. And yet, in your new bill, you basically say, you know, we're gonna sidestep or bi-step that process so that we can go right ahead and inform this map. Can you talk again why it is that you think that you don't need to involve that public process in the creation of the map?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I'll give you two answers to that. One is, again, and you had it in your question, we're not ordering anybody to do anything in terms of providing a service that they wouldn't have provided. I clearly think anytime we're going to change obligations on people in some significant way, we ought to have, you know, public hearing process. But this is just kind of a communication tool. So that's answer number one. And then answer number two, I think things work well enough here that we're talking about consultation. We can sit down and we oftentimes do have discussions of various issues in the insurance world. It's a relatively small world here still in Oregon, and basically work things out in some of these kind of situations where you don't necessarily have to have a full-scale public hearing. But it's a judgment call. I won't pretend to you that it would be the end of the world if we still had to have public hearings to create market assistance plans. It would just mean in difficult situations it would take a little longer. The notice provisions on that are, you know, filed by the 10th of the month in order to hold a public hearing by the end of the following month. So, you know, you end up with a 2 or 3 month process usually. Sometimes that may be longer than people want to wait in the market, but they're good questions.
And I think this will be my last question. A JUA, you could, if there's nobody that's offering insurance in a particular line, for whatever reason, and you basically create a JUA, then in some respects, the state is in the insurance business. I mean, the state is the insurer. You're assessing the insurance companies to provide the resources for the insurance to be made available. And maybe this is a two-part question, so I'll get two questions in here in my last question. And yet, in the new bill, we're contemplating the state becoming potentially an insurance company or offering insurance. And yet, we don't go through kind of the less onerous process of a map first. In current statute, you got to do the map first before you go to JUA. And yet, it seems to me that going to a JUA is a pretty serious step for the state to take. You just want to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, yes. In the example you proposed where there aren't any insurance companies, the state could be in the role of becoming essentially a state insurance company that would take assessments and have to manage the business. I think that'd be an unlikely scenario in which there was no insurance company. But to go back to your question, if there were literally no insurers in a particular market, that would be even the most, that would be the situation in which it would not make any sense, really, from my perspective, to create a map, because there'd literally be nobody to be participating in your map. So I don't even know what exactly we'd do if we were held a hearing and decided we had to create a map and nobody was there to actually do anything. And
then answer the general question about why we skip the map process to go to the JUA.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think we would not skip the market assistance plan step in any case where the market assistance plan had some utility. So if you take the medical malpractice market in Oregon today, there are just two carriers. Well, now there's actually a few more. There's a few more, but assume we're down to just two. You know, probably isn't going to be the case that the problem in that kind of marketplace is that the doctors don't know who to go, where the insurance is. So a market assistance plan has got to have, it works in a situation where there are more than a couple insurers and there's some genuine issue about whether the insureds know how to find the insurance resource. If that's true, then we would create a market assistance plan. But if it's not true, if there really aren't, you know, more than one or two options, or if there are no options in the insurance world for people, then to create a market assistance plan for people to find out that there are no options for them doesn't really accomplish anything. That's our point about moving straight to but I would not anticipate we would do that except in those sort of extreme circumstances.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, yeah. for allowing this conversation.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Any other questions?
Well,
Senator
Jay. Just one, and it was, and why not public hearing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, we do maintain the public hearing requirement for a joint underwriting association. Just for what we say is for a market assistance plan consultation in a situation where we want to move quickly, we think is sufficient.
To not have to forego that public hearing.
Yes.
But that, Mr. Chair, obviously mm-hmm. I would think that it's not something that's a barrier if it was required to have a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, if that were an amendment to the bill, I think we wouldn't have a big problem with that.
Thank you.
I think you can count on that part. Because it really isn't that big of a process, Mr. Ariel. You do have to post, but it's not months to have the hearing. You can do that. But I also think that one of the advantages of having a public hearing is that it also allows at least the opportunity to communicate the need to the public, which is, I think, an important step. Mr. Ariel, thank you very much. And he's also a seer. Mr. Ariel is. He has predicted that people are about to come to tell us why this is a terrible idea. And so we will see if he is right.
Mr. Chair, I do have to say one last thing. Sam Storch is coming pretty shortly after me.
He's
even a bigger mucky muck than me in the national scene. Okay. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Sam Storch and Jack Monroe, let's ask them to come forward. We're going to kind of flip-flop here back and forth on the issue.
Let's see here, mucky.
I'll let you select how you want to begin. Welcome.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe. I'm speaking on behalf of the American Insurance Association and the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Oregon. 2 days ago, we were here, and John Powell was before you, and, you know, given his sort of ridden hard and put away wet look, he gave credence to the fact that there were some parallels between John and Denny Grange, the egocentric but forgetful attorney, our boss at legal. Unfortunately, I share some characteristics with Senator Decker, and my youthful appearance might lead you to conclude that I've just arrived in the Capitol. But in fact, I was around in 1987 when the series of statutes that are before you in this bill were carefully crafted and I think crafted for some reasons that continue to be valid today. And there was the statutes as they exist, and I think as Joel has correctly described, are sort of sequential. There are two mechanisms that are set forth that allow the state to get involved in the insurance market in one way or another. The least aggressive being a market assistance plan, the more aggressive being the MUA. And the legislature at the time concluded that, as you have, that it made sense, of course, for both practical and philosophical reasons, to try the least aggressive before you got involved in the more aggressive. And it set up the process that's been described. Public hearing to collect information, getting some experts involved, the industry, and then adopting whatever the plan is by rule, and it could be a temporary rule or a time rule, and seeing if that particular option works. And if that particular option doesn't work, then you move to the possible creation of a joint underwriting authority, which really does put the state in the business by virtue of having created an alternative insurance mechanism. And that was the process that was set up. And it was set up for some interesting reasons that I think still have validity. And that is that JUAs of that time that had been created, often for Med-Mal purposes, a problem that still is with us, were almost all financially underwater. And I remember going through my file from that era, and New Jersey, for example, had created one for auto, and it was $3 billion underwater. Now, you can create a mechanism like you do in the Oregon statute where you say the Oregon legislature isn't responsible. Victorian books, black buildings. If we ever end up creating one, not knowing what we're doing, and we end up with any kind of significant liability, I would not want to be in that place, as respective of language that may be in the statute. And so, you know, those reasons, I guess I'm glad to hear there are GUAs, there are more market assistance plans elsewhere in the country, but I understand there are also GUAs that are operating now, and I guess it's reassuring to find out that there are a couple that may be operating both well and are solvent. But neither of these mechanisms are mechanisms that we ought to get involved in casually. And so we would conclude, I guess, in going through and looking at the changes, and there's already been some good discussion, but certainly as it relates to the map, we think that the existing process requiring public hearings makes sense. We also believe that consulting with the industry makes sense, and I think our most recent exercise supports that. Now, Oregon hasn't used either of these mechanisms for the 17, I guess, the statute's been on the books. But it had nothing to do with the impossibility of utilizing the mechanisms. I can assure you of that. I've served, had the pleasure and the privilege of dealing with every insurance commissioner and every administrator of the division since then. And it had nothing to do with the impossibility of dealing with it. The other thing, Joel and I have, I guess, a different memory of what the experience of last year, which was our initial effort to use these statutes, what occurred during that year. He suggested somehow that it took more than a year to get this this off the ground, and I mean it may have been more than a year from the time they first had a discussion within the division, but it wasn't more than a year between the time that the hearing required by statute was held, April 7, 2004, and the time the rule was adopted putting the market assistance plan in place. And the industry was responsive. There was some confusion because while they held an informal meeting in early May following that hearing, bringing together a series of us to have a discussion about it, they didn't really compose a task force to deal with this until sometime in June. And we had a meeting in early July, delivered a sort of conceptual product, but we also had some questions and some natural questions because their list of things that they wanted didn't match up with things that could be done. And we delivered a more final web-based product in late July. And so not only was there willingness on the part of the industry to deal with the division, but I think it all occurred with great speed, actually, considering the fact that there was some uncertainty at a couple points in time because it was the first time we'd gone through it. And frankly, interestingly enough, I found no evidence elsewhere of a web-based map, and so we were cutting new ground. And it was not only sort of how you did it, but how it worked out mechanically. And again, so I don't think the experience of this last year supports the contention that we either shouldn't have a public hearing or that the industry should not play a very significant role in putting together the mechanism. And the mechanism will vary depending, form follows function, depending upon what you're dealing with and what kind of a market and what kind of a line you're dealing with, the form may vary considerably. So we think that the existing provisions relative to a map and the prerequisites make good sense. As it relates to the formation of a joint underwriting authority, again, consistent with, I think there was wisdom in the 87 process, which said you'll try the least aggressive before you try the more aggressive. Markets don't go hard immediately. And, you know, I guess I have some problem understanding the hypothetical that was put forward, that suddenly we went from bountiful insurance coverage to none overnight. It doesn't work that way. And so I think, again, that the process we have here, which sees you developing and clearing the house before you get yourself in the insurance business, makes good sense. We would also, and we have not yet seen the amendments, although I have seen them in insurance division form. I haven't seen them in final form. There's absolutely no doubt that if these are put together, the rates that are charged by this association have to be actuarially sound and have to be calculated to be self-supporting. And if they are not, either the state is setting itself up for, you know, a significant problem, or you're setting up the people who are being covered for downstream implications that they're not. And so I understand that they've put, that they're suggesting the amendment putting back the actuarially sound rates language in Section 7 on line 17, but I do not understand why at the same time they're not putting the language back in on line 21 and 22 that says that all rates that are approved for this joint underwriting association will be actuarially sound and calculated to be self-supporting. That language also needs to go back in to make this make sense. The other thing I guess I would comment on briefly, the language that's currently there has a trigger that talks about availability and affordability. And certainly at some point in time, things become so unaffordable that they become unavailable to a great part of the market, and we understand that. But you know what we end up here on a spectrum, I guess, now we have an availability at one end and unaffordability at the other, and so what we're saying is you don't trigger these things until you're someplace past center. And you've got a situation here where they're essentially suggesting that they'll trigger it for lack of affordability. And I don't know what that means, absent a definition. I don't know if that means that there's a 50% increase in premiums as to whether or not that's unaffordable when we trigger this process. And again, given the importance, I think, and the downside risk of these mechanisms, I think we need to know that. So we believe that the existing language makes very good sense. Let me see if there was anything else that I really.
Well, Mr. Monroe, just because I want to make sure everybody has an opportunity, while you look that over, let's go to Mr. Sorich and ask him to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Sam Sorich. I'm Vice President with the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, PCI. We're an association of property casualty insurance companies. About 300 of our members are doing business in Oregon, and our members are responsible for about 30% of the commercial liability premiums written in the state. We have five reasons for opposing Senate Bill 116. The trigger for the creation of the Joint Underwriting Association in the bill would be availability or affordability. This is a departure from the fundamental concept of joint underwriting associations. Joint underwriting associations traditionally have been formed, and the two JUAs that Director Ario mentioned were formed based on objective information about the lack of availability of insurance. Affordability is a concept distinct from availability. Affordability is a subjective concept. What may be affordable in the eyes of someone may be unaffordable in the eyes of someone else. So that term is undefined and gives us great concern that there is little statutory guidance to determine when a joint underwriting association would be created. We think the proper concept to guide the creation of a joint underwriting association is evidence about the availability or lack of availability of insurance. Affordability is a concept that does not belong in a joint underwriting association. Our second reason for opposing the bill is the deletion of the requirement that a market assistance plan be given an opportunity to work before the radical step of creating a joint underwriting association is undertaken. We think it would be wrong to jump to the conclusion or adopt a preconceived notion that insurance is not available. We think a market assistance plan should be given a chance to work. Our third reason for opposing the bill is the actuarial soundness provision. Now, we did hear from Director Ario that that concept is being put back into the statute with their drafted amendments, and that's a good thing. It's essential that a joint underwriting association's rates be actuarial sound. The rates that we charge as insurance companies must be actuarial sound. So if the joint underwriting association was allowed to charge rates that were not sound, well, what would happen would be businesses would flock to the joint underwriting association, and that's not what our goal should be. We want to keep the market alive, not destroy the market. The fourth reason for opposing the bill is in Section 10 of the bill. What Section 10 would do would remove the provision that says that the losses of a joint underwriting association cannot inure to the detriment of insurance companies. What this provision would do, instead of solving the market problems, would make them worse. What this provision does is tell insurance companies, if you continue to write commercial liability insurance, there is a greater danger for every premium dollar that you write, there's a greater danger that you are going to be stuck with the losses of the joint underwriting association. What that tells a company is not to come into the market, is to exit the market, to stay away from the market because of the potential losses that the joint underwriting association could impose on a company that's voluntarily participating in the commercial liability market. Our fifth reason for opposing the bill is that a market assistance plan or a joint underwriting association is not the ultimate solution to the problem. In fact, what it does is paper over the problem. The reason that insurance companies may not be writing in a market is because of the costs of that market, of the uncertainty of doing business. So the real solution to problems in the liability market is not papering it over with a joint underwriting association, but trying to address the fundamental problems in our liability system, to try to do something about the cost of lawsuits and the exposure that businesses encounter through their liability lawsuits. So those are the reasons for opposition to the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. I'm going to ask Mr. Monroe if you found one other thing you want to comment on. Otherwise, we'll open with questions.
One point I failed to make, Mr. Troy's made.
No, that's how you're supposed to ham and egg it.
Good.
Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get insurance because I want to be covered if something goes bad. Insurance companies want to insure someone who they think is not going to have a problem. I mean, insurance companies have the reputation of wanting to make sure that they insure people that don't have a lot of risk. And I know because I lost my car insurance back when I was 25 and I was in a car accident, and they did pay, but they dropped my insurance. We have a problem, particularly with contractor liability, and at least from my area. We definitely have a problem with medical malpractice, and now we're developing a problem with adult foster care. And this bill, I think, is attempting to to bring the insurance companies to try to solve that problem. And I would like to see something work out rather than just saying this isn't going to work, because in order we need to have these areas covered. So can you just say something about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have in our statute today a mechanism to address those market problems. There is a
follow-up. You said it made sense, but it's not. There hasn't been a market assistance program or a JUA at all in Oregon. So you say we have a mechanism, but it's not working.
Let me take a shot at it, Mr. Chair, Senator. I think Mr. Arya was correct in saying that as it relates to these various markets that have been distressed for one reason or another, there are a variety of different potential causation factors. And, some of them are cyclical to the extent that, one of the factors that's often at play, if the market, stock markets are bad, the value of our surplus goes down. Companies can only write on a ratio of, so much risk to so much surplus. You wouldn't want, for example, somebody out selling life insurance policies that didn't have any money to pay for them. That's a Ponzi scheme in another world. What happens in that circumstance, of course, is that companies, not having the capacity to write, start to contract, if you will, their involvement in the market. And it might be writing less of a certain kind of product, or it might be getting out of lines where they can't adequately either assess the risk or price the risk. Now, we have, as I said, 17 years ago, Med-Mal was a problem in Oregon. That was one of the things that drove the discussion there. It's still a problem. And as Mr. Sorensen suggested, these mechanisms don't solve the problem. The reason that you have a problem in the Med-Mal market is because there are some underlying problems that the delivery system here has no control. And, it isn't, you were maybe suggesting that insurance companies' interest in profitability somehow drives this mechanism. But if you look at the Med-Mal market, you've got two participants in the state of Oregon, one of which is a mutual owned by doctors, and they're struggling to keep their head above water.
And so you spread the risk.
There are underlying problems. Well, it is a mechanism for spreading risk. And so, as Mr. Sorensen is suggesting, this is putting wallpaper over a leak. And if you really want to deal with problems, there are more fundamental issues that have to be dealt with that aren't the scope or function of this rule or this proposed bill. Excuse me.
Other questions for these two gentlemen? Time, Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find I agree with both sides on this. But I think it's because I think they're relatively, in listening, and I had the fortune of having both Mr. Arya and then the insurance industry back-to-back on this one. And it seems to me that they're relatively close. And if I could just ask two questions that go into what the two areas that, I don't recall your last name.
Sorich.
Mr. Sorich, that you had mentioned. On the question of affordability, my guess would be that on affordability is that there is a synergy between affordability and unavailability, in the sense that if it is so exorbitantly expensive, it's going to make it unaffordable. And though I've never tried to write a definition, I think it would be feasible to write a definition of unaffordability, and perhaps that is in relation to other similar categories of insurance and two or three times the rate of a similar, if you're thinking adult foster care, maybe it's a nursing home that would be the most similar facility, and if it was two or three times more, would that be a fair definition of affordability that would make it therefore unavailable?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, I do not agree with that. The concept of affordability is whether or not an individual business perceives the rate that is being charged to be something that it can afford. That is inherently a subjective determination that's going to vary from business to business. The rates that we as insurance companies charge are based on the costs that we incur. Mm-hmm. And they're regulated by the Division of Insurance. So to come up with some sort of formula that compares business insurance with homeowners insurance, I think is an inappropriate approach. I think the proper determination, the proper objective test is in the statute today, whether or not insurance is available, whether or not there are insurance companies in the marketplace offering insurance coverage. That should be the basic determination of whether a market assistance plan or a joint underwriting association is undertaken.
So, Mr. Chair, so there would be no circumstances in your mind, and you probably see the distinction between the perspective you would have and the perspective we have removed from the industry, but trying to look after these really hard markets and make a call on them. There'd be no situation in your mind that affordability or unaffordability would preclude whether it's Med-Mal, construction, or adult foster care, would preclude someone from being able to buy the insurance. Because if you set that test, to me, you've rendered your answer at that point. Because if I'm an insurance company, I'll charge such a high rate. It's available. It's just at such a high level that, therefore, I've met the test. It's available. It's just I'm assured no one is going to enter that. But you have a better perspective on this than I do.
Mr. Chair, Senator, well, the fact is we cannot charge any rate we want. We cannot pick a number out and just charge a rate. The rates that insurance companies charge have to be based on the statistical evidence of what the risk of loss should be. Of course, the legislature could decide to trigger a market assistance plan or a joint underwriting association based on affordability, but I believe that would be a very unwise choice because inherent in that is the intent to do something to artificially suppress the price of insurance. And that has ramifications that, again, make this and other problems worse rather than resolving the situation.
One more question, yes. Mr. Chair. And thank you for that answer. What if we do not pass this bill out and we're in, say, July and Oregon is done, the legislature is done, what incentive would you have to enter into a MAP if we're adjourned and on one of these hard markets and Mr. Ario calls you and says, I know the legislation was defeated, but we've got this other market. Mr. Monroe, can you meet me in a week or two and let's...
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I know that there was the inference in Administrator Ario's comments that somehow we were driven to the table by virtue of the fact that the 2005 legislative session was just over the horizon. But that isn't the case, at least from my perspective. We have to deal with the administrator on a regular basis. And in almost all instances, we find that interaction to be both fruitful and productive. But to answer your question, if we get to August and we have a problem and he calls, we will respond as we always have responded, and as we responded the last time around. And there wasn't any foot dragging the last time around, and there won't be any foot dragging the next time around. I mean, there's too much leverage on the other side, frankly.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just my last. And I understand that. If I'm putting myself in your shoes, yes, it's a market that there's no return or there very little. I'm trying to think what my incentive would be to. I mean, I would have very little, and I agree with you in terms of the two recommendations you had. If this were to go forward in terms of actuarial soundness, which I think the department is agreeing with you, and then that you should do a market assistance plan before you do a JUA. I think that should be a requirement in the legislation that would be first. But without that, at the end of the day, I'm trying to think how I would have any incentive other than just the good person that you are, Mr. Monroe, and being diligent and wanting to maintain that relation. It'd be a hard one for me to want to rush to that table or even promptly come to that table.
Well, I Senator, I mean, as I suggested at the end, there's all kinds of leverage on the other side relative to our relationship or the insurance industry's relationship with its regulator. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to go to war, you're very careful about selecting the time and the issues, and this isn't going to be one of them. Oh. Now, as it relates to the issue that I think you're most interested in, which is this construction liability issue, it is a complicated issue, and there are a series of pieces of legislation in this building, I think some of which are before this committee and some of which are before other committees, that deal with what are some of the perceived problems, and I say perceived, we probably believe they are problems, but perceived problems with the process, and Mr. Shorich alluded to one of them. I mean, there are some litigation-related concerns here. There are also concerns with some of the things that the home building and the building industry are doing out there, and so there's probably a need for certain kinds of activity to help those who regulate that industry weed out the performers from the non-performers. There are a variety of different measures out there that this legislature will be contemplating, and I would hope that at least some of them will be seriously considered and enacted. I will hope they will have the same, what we think to be positive, based on what may be preliminary information, the same positive impact that the proposals the proposal you enacted last session that said, the builder has to be given an opportunity to correct the problem before we march to the courthouse. And I hope we build on that foundation and deal with some of those problems. And to the extent that happens, insurers will be able to assess the nature of that risk and price that risk better, and they will be there. And the other point I think you need to understand about this construction liability issue, what you were really talking about are people that are involved in maybe three or four dozen of the classifications out there that make up the construction spectrum. And those are the people that are currently having problems. There are people involved in a whole raft of other construction-related activities that don't have the same problem that brings us here and prompts the discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Stark.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. In the experience that the department went through to create the map last summer, in that experience, is there no opportunities for improvement that you would recommend? This statute, as you drafted it way back when in 1987, was perfect, operated perfectly. There's no improvements that could be done to make it work any better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, one, of course, I didn't write the statute in 1987, but I think the process that to the extent that we had a problem, and I don't think we really had any significant problems, I think they weren't attributable to the process. They were attributable to the fact that we were doing it for the first time. We were breaking new ground in terms of using a web-based format, an exclusively web-based format. And, as I suggested, I think we went from sort of casual discussion to the development and the delivery of a model absent some information data processing tweaks that had to be done within 2 months. And I don't think that's a long period of time. I mean, it wasn't the process. It was sort of the getting to know you and trying to understand what you wanted and trying to use this new mechanism to deliver the product. So,
and one additional one, Mr. Chair. They, in a number of places in the bill, they use subclass of insurance as opposed to classes of business or lines of business. Is there any concern? Is that just definitional? It means the same thing, or is that substantive to the bill and its and how it, what kind of reaction does it generate?
I think Mr. Sorich referred. Didn't you refer to the subclass issue? I think in one part they're simply trying to target the delivery mechanism. But you raised a second issue, did you not, about?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think my point was that the elimination of the protection that's now in the Joint Underwriting Association statute that says that if the Joint Underwriting Association has losses, that those losses cannot be imposed on other insurance companies writing liability insurance, the bill takes that away. And my concern is that by taking that away, we would be sending a message to other liability carriers who are now writing business that, hey, it's dangerous to write because you are exposing yourself to the potential of being assessed for the Joint Underwriting Association's losses.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the problems is Mr. Shortz is suggesting, if I might call up Mr. Chair, you know, if you in a lot of these in a lot of these commercial areas, you know, there are very much specialties, and only certain insurers are involved in those specialties. I mean, certain people, and only certain people, know boilers. And so if you're creating one of these mechanisms to deal with one of these specialty areas, you run a risk if you somehow have swept in people who don't know anything about that business and who are providing the services that might go beyond what a commercial insurer might provide to those parties. So you know, I think there's some element of concern there.
Okay, what I'm going to do here, thank you, gentlemen, very much. I think we're starting to frame some of the issues. What we've done so far, Mr. Ariel and Mr. Sorich, Mr. Monroe, I think we've gotten a good flavor of the beginning of this, and I think there really are some issues. I want to make just two announcements, because I'm always trying to be watchful of the time and make sure that just because they were first that other people didn't have a chance to talk. Senate Bill 463, we clearly, Mr. Ariel, aren't going to get to today, so I just want that to be known. We have about 25 more minutes left in committee, and I'm going to try to get through this, and I'm going to tell you, you know, that we've got about I've got two individuals I'm going to bring up now who are going to testify in favor, and ask that you have 8 or 9 minutes. If you, I know you have some written testimony, submit that so we can get a flavor for that. This bill will be coming back. And then I'm going to have two more opponents, Mr. Powell, Ms. Betterfield, and ask that they confine their remarks to anything different than Mr. Sorich and Mr. Monroe provided us, so we can get a flavor for that, and then end with Mr. Chandler and Mr. Kafouri. So Janet, Ahrens, and Chris, it's Bountiful, and if I said that wrong, please correct me. If you could come forward. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Janet Ahrens. I am the executive director of the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. We're a nonprofit association of children's service providers throughout the state of Oregon, representing 33 member agencies, about $150 million worth of services to children and families. We have 250 programs throughout Oregon and all of your districts that touch about 78,000 children's lives throughout the course of any year. We might be an unusual element for you to have testifying in front of your committee on this matter, but we have also experienced the results of a hard market around liability insurance for For our programs, and it's created significant problems for us, and I wanted to share some of that information with you. We support the bill because we believe it provides a very reasonable, very achievable strategy for stabilizing the industry when mandatory insurance coverage, which we're required to have through our contracts primarily with you, becomes extremely limited or extremely expensive. One of the questions that Senator Starr alluded to, I think, earlier in testimony was asking a little bit about what the industries, individual industries, might be doing to help themselves to mitigate these costs. And we do realize that there are both internal issues that drive costs in insurance as well as external issues. Some of the internal issues are what you're doing to try and mitigate the number of claims, what kind of risk management plans you have. In our case, are we training and educating both volunteers and our staffs appropriately? And what are we doing to market ourselves to brokers so that they understand clearly what it is that we're doing, who we're doing it for, and what we've done to try and mitigate potential for future claims? In preparation for this hearing, we surveyed our members to find out what they had experienced. I wanted to be able to bring you some hard numbers. I have tons of anecdotal information, but to just cut to the chase in the interest of time around the survey results, we found, first of all, that every one of our members responding to that survey had experienced an increase in the premium since 2001. The average increase is around 35%, which is pretty significant. The lucky ones got off with around 8 to 10%, which represents a pricing index that we would expect with inflation. But some of our members experienced up to as much as 80% or more increase in the premiums. And in a case like that, you've got a nonprofit organization paying a $300,000 annual insurance premium just for liability insurance, and the bulk of their funds that are coming in to support their agency and the services that are delivered are on fixed contracts with the state that have not received any cost of living increases. So when you talk a little bit about what a definition of affordability is, it may not be specific to a certain percentage increase. It may be, there might be other ways to look at that or define that. We also recognize that there are other external forces that may be driving the cost of insurance. Our premiums increased in 2002 and continue to increase over the 3 years subsequent, which we have been explained to is due in part to external factors from our industry, stock market not performing well, Catholic Church claims, 9/11 claims. Somebody else mentioned earlier today, now we have the 4 hurricanes in Florida that have come through. So although we're doing what we can to try and market our industry and make ourselves affordable, sometimes there are other outside forces that are driving that, which makes it very challenging for us. Not only have we had to address significant increases in the cost of the insurance, we've also suffered a loss of insurers, reduced coverage, and increased deductibles. So it's compounded in more than one way. Half of our members who were seeking coverage had to change insurance carriers because the premium was no longer affordable. But the market in which they had to shop was very limited. And in fact, more than a third of them, had their coverage terminated by carriers who were no longer producing for the line. The question that Senator Mona Sanderson asked a little bit earlier about sort of giving me a real example of what might happen as a result of loss of insurance coverage or coverage that's not affordable. That's 78,000 children that we take care of every year are at the direction of the state, who for the most part has custody of those children. And when we get a 30-day notice that insurance coverage is not available, we need to find new coverage. We have to make contingency plans for what we're going to do with those children and how we're going to help those families if the coverage isn't able to be achieved. And in those cases, the contingency plan is to negotiate with the state the return of those children. So it's very challenging for us. It's been a very hard 3 years. We support the bill because it offers some alternatives to us. We've been in conversation with the department for about a year and a half about alternatives, and it's been challenging for them to support us as well. We're hoping that your support on the bill will help change that. I'd also like to introduce Chris Bonnet, who is here with one of our member agencies. He, in a past life, was a reporter and a journalist who studied the insurance industry, among other things. And he understands a little bit more about the bill's concepts and why it's important to us as an industry, and helped me understand what interests you as a committee may have in knowing why we're looking at this alternative.
Thank you. I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm with Trillium Family Services. We are a statewide provider of children's mental health care, and our agency specializes in high-end residential care in addition to other services such as outpatient and community-based care. We as an individual consumer, Trillium, and among our peer agencies that are represented in the Oregon Alliance, support this bill. From a consumer perspective, it was mentioned that hard cycles don't come quickly, but from a consumer, they do. Often we are given 30 days to respond to conditions from our insurer, whether it is an increase in our premium or whether it is a cancellation notice. And in the insurance cycle as it is now, there are certain inefficiencies that work to the detriment of consumers, and one of them is information sharing. Within a 30-day period, you operate essentially in a silo, and with your broker and maybe through informal phone calls and other things, you have to quickly make a decision on what is available and what is affordable. The market assistance plan is one mechanism that would help create a more level playing field from a consumer perspective, because we have to operate so quickly. Insurance companies have the benefit of sharing information, of looking at market trends. We don't necessarily have that, and a market assistance plan certainly provides us that communication vehicle and that clearinghouse to be able to shop as informed consumers for the type of liability insurance that we need. I would also say that address the issue of affordability and availability, and again echo a little bit of what Ms. Aaron said, is that for us affordability and availability are not mutually exclusive. They are the same thing. If we do have carriers in the state willing to write our line and address our book of business, but seeing that we are on a fixed revenue stream that has remained for us unchanged for 3 years, affordability becomes an issue. And in our area, the insurers who are willing to write in our area are constantly changing, and especially in a hard market, you see insurers pulling out, pulling in, and if there is no way to share information or to assess affordability, again, we're as consumers at a very grave disadvantage. So that centralized source is very important for us, and that's why we are encouraged to see that the market assistance plan is being strengthened and why affordability is being added into the statute. For a joint underwriting association, when we are able to hit a deeper crisis, it at least gives us a safety net that would... in a sense, it doesn't solve the problems of an insurance cycle, but it helps even out the volatility of the insurance cycle for us and would give us that safety net because, as Ms. Aaron pointed out, if we don't have insurance, we are unable to care for the children who need our services, and it becomes a crisis not only for us insurance-wise, but a crisis for the children and families who we serve. Thank you.
Thank you. So if I can... summarize what I've heard from you, especially Ms. Aaron's, and your closing comment, was that for you affordability means, if the bottom line is, it means reduced services to the children and the other populations you serve because of that cost, then that's unaffordable.
It certainly, yes, would be the short answer. It's one of the considerations that we have to address.
And you kind of measure that by, you know, we have to serve less individuals because of this cost eating that up, and we don't have the comparative income coming in, and so that would be a measuring stick for you folks. Yep. Thank you very much for sharing your testimony.
Thank you.
I want to move on. Lana Butterfield, John Powell, you're professionals. You do an excellent job. I'm sure you know the holes that Jack and Sam missed, and you'll fill those in only and not reiterate that testimony. And then Mr. Chandler and Mr. Crafori will close us out. And again, we will be dealing with this issue beyond today. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell. Before you today, representing several insurers who called about this bill, so you've been very good for business.
We do our best to help you. We're also the economic development.
Yes. The insurers include State Farm Insurance, Liberty Northwest, doing business as North Pacific Insurance Company, that I've represented for a long time, AIG, and Contractors Bonding and Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman, members, I will keep it very brief, simply to reemphasize a couple things. One, there is a current map currently instituted and being used, and I think there was a little confusion about one that had never been created. There's one right now that's being used in the contractor line. But the most subtle, I think, issue here is the one that was discussed about putting back in the actuarial sound language. The rates are filed with the insurance division now and reviewed. And they're reviewed based on whether or not they are sound, whether they provide the kind of revenue to pay the claims based on that company's experience. That's currently how they're reviewed. If, on the other hand, you simply say we're going to use actuarially sound rates in the JUA, then if you do this lightly, all you've done is transferred some added costs of doing business over to this column. And if both rates are actuarially sound, they're going to be similar, unless the plan is to create some kind of subsidy. So I think you need to answer that question. Is this to set up a subsidization process, or is this to resolve an availability problem? Because they're two different things. I have handed out to you an article that appeared in the Salem Chamber of Commerce newspaper. It was written by a third party, had nobody related to insurance was involved. But this reporter contacted contractors in the Salem area, and I've highlighted a few of their quotes. And I quote from one: as one local building contractor stated, 4 years ago we were receiving within 4 years we are receiving a letter on every single project we've constructed, and we are a widely respected contractor, best in town. Those letters came from lawyers. The next one: one Salem contractor stated, I've never had a claim in 30 years until these last 2 years, when suddenly everyone learns they can make a buck in these lawsuits. The next highlighted one, and I quote, we will get quoted better insurance rates when we have better building practices implemented in all areas of construction, from design to product to build, states one Salem construction expert. Goes on to quote, in California, nearly every single condominium project built in that state in the last 5 years has ended in a lawsuit. The West Coast has been inundated with lawsuits in this area. At the hearing on the map, I presented loss data from Liberty Northwest North Pacific Insurance Company. They're losing about $1.65 for every dollar they take in on the contractor line. They're staying in business because they want to accommodate their agents, and they're trying to stay in this business without growing, because if you're losing $1.65 for every dollar, you don't want a whole lot more dollars. So they're trying to keep their market share at about the same to help with this problem. But the losses are real, and the losses are there. Finally, we are hopefully in the process of transcribing the hearing that preceded the map. And if the tapes are good enough for transcription, we'll be able to provide you with a copy of what contractors said and insurers said and other people said at that hearing, which I think was a value to everybody who attended and participated in that process. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the current process, I think, does work. There's been no attempt to go to a JUA, as has been stated, even though there is a provision in the law. I contend, if you look at the current markets for contractors, you probably wouldn't go to a JUA right now because there is some availability in the marketplace. Does it cost a lot? Yes. Why? Because it's costing a lot to provide it. And those figures are filed with the insurance division, and I will get the ones that the company I represented presented at that hearing for you as well.
That would be very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Powell. Ms. Butterfield?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here today representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. We rarely oppose a division-sponsored bill, but this one our agents are very exercised about. You will see on the last page of my testimony that PIA, professional insurance agents, have been providing their own voluntary internal market assistance program since actually 2001. So we've been very willing to work in this issue because we know it's been difficult for contractors. I do have 2 points. First of all, no one has really talked about page 2, lines 29 through 32, that has to do with deletion of legitimate insurance underwriting considerations, and we believe it's important that you keep that in the bill. I would also say that our agents are most exercised about doing away with a map, and if you heard Director Ario talking about how he wouldn't do away with a map unless there were no companies writing, I think you could amend that language so that it would they would have to do the map unless no companies were writing, and that might take care of Commissioner Ario's concern. I would also note that in Washington State, a similar bill failed last year.
Well, that doesn't mean we're smarter than they are, so that doesn't mean anything does. Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Mr. Chandler, Mr. Ford to come forward.
We can beat Washington.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll show them what we can do that they can do, right? Again, we'll be having this bill back. I think we're getting some good questions that we're going to be asking both proponents and opponents on this. So, Mr. Chandler, you have signed up next, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler of the Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of Senate Bill 116. I'll defer to all the smart folks in the room on the insurance piece of it. I would like to spend a little bit of time talking about the impact of the liability crisis on the home building industry. It has been dire. As Mr. Powell mentioned during the MAP hearing, we heard from contractors who couldn't get insurance, rates have gone up. I know of many who have gone out of business because they could not afford it. I don't know if the JUA, as proposed in this bill and the amendments, is the answer. Probably isn't. It may be an answer, and it's certainly a tool that we can use in the toolbox of trying to provide liability insurance, which is required by state law currently. And so my folks end up in a box. We have a statute that says you have to carry it. You certainly have an obligation as a business person to have insurance to cover losses and catastrophic events. You have an obligation to your consumer, and it is very expensive. With regard to some of the comments you've heard, Mr. Chairman, I think it's critical to have affordability as part of this. Now, I understand the difference between availability and affordability. I also understand, though, that at some point, if you have several 100%, in some cases I'm aware of up to 800-1,000% price increases, that is so unaffordable as to become unavailable. There is a point at which those lines cross. Now, what the measurement is, I do not know. I'd be happy to help participate in writing that. I think some sort of objective measurement may be useful. But I also know that to say that, well, as long as there's some available in the marketplace, flies in the face of credulity. If you're having to shell out $1 million of insurance premium for $1 million of coverage, that may be available, but it's not particularly useful. With regard to the subclass that's called out in this bill, I think that's also critical. As has been observed, not every aspect of the construction industry is being hit by this. General contractors are, certainly. And many of the specialties, roofing in particular, some of the ones that have had more claims for all sorts of reasons, need to have separate treatment and to treat the entire, all the SIC codes contained within the construction industry as one entity is silly. So I think being able for the department to be able to classify by impact zone, so to speak, makes a whole lot of sense. And finally, and I have not seen the amendments. I've been told what they said. There's a couple things in there that sound very useful to me, and one of them is the Oregon-only experience. One of the things, I have spent the better part of this last year trying to get my hands around this issue for my industry. One of the things I've always been most happy about in my professional career, both as an attorney and as an advocate for home builders, is that I didn't have to do insurance. And that would get me out of bed with a spring in my step, because no matter how bad things got, I didn't have to do insurance. I feel like I should be carrying around a crucifix and garlic with me now that I am having to do insurance. But what I found in discussing this issue with Marsh, with other insurance companies around the country, with risk retention groups, with self-insured, with my colleagues elsewhere, is that we do not have a good data set for the risks in Oregon. We are up against tort claims in Texas and subsidence claims in Colorado and class action problems in California. Many of those do not exist here, but the premium base that the industry uses, and I understand why they do. I'm not criticizing them. I understand, at least I think I understand, how the insurance market works. But an Oregon-only base of numbers, I think, would be beneficial for us, certainly, because I don't think our contractors and our legal system have the same problems that have happened in other parts of the country. If we can, under the amendments as proposed by the department, if we can start focusing the attention on getting a data set for Oregon and wall ourselves off from the problems in California, Texas, and elsewhere, that's got to be beneficial for us and for the insurance industry, because then we're actually working off the right data set. We would be more than happy to participate in any future conversations on this bill. I think, again, it may not be the answer, but we desperately, members of the committee, please, we desperately need some help here. This is not only an important part of the Oregon economy, but it's an important part of Oregon communities. And too many people are having to pay too much or quit what they're doing because of the absence of the affordability of liability insurance. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Okay. I'm going to have Mr. Kafoury make it. You've got a couple of minutes. Mr. Kafoury.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Stephen Kafoury. I'm here representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. I'll try not to be redundant to Mr. Chandler's comments, but I think the chair and the committee may owe us a debt of gratitude. We could have had this building filled with angry contractors and angry ex-contractors. We did have a huge turnout at that MAP hearing of people, and the $1 million cost for $1 million insurance is not an example of hyperbole on Mr. Chandler's part. That's an exact situation that happened to some people who wanted to self-insure. We had insurance costs of that. The issue of affordability is real. If you have, as we had, I heard just yesterday at one of my remodelers' meetings, a person who has a net income of about $70,000 a year had his insurance increased from $8,000 to $20,000. That puts a person in a position of, do I continue in business or not? At some point, when you cannot pay more in insurance than you get in profits, it just doesn't work. And it may be available in lots and lots and lots of companies out there, but if you can't afford it, it's not available to you. So the issue available is very real. We are required, as Ms. Chandler said, by state law to provide insurance in order to be licensed. The problem that's occurring now is people are facing, do I go uninsured, do I break the law in order to continue operating a business, or do I go out of business? And there are a lot of folks are facing that. The insurance company talked about, and we just heard them say, well, you know, we had a hearing way last summer and things are progressing along just really fine. It may be for the insurance companies a very acceptable pace, but if you just received the notice from your insurance company that you have 2 months or a month, at the end of that period of time, you're not going to have any insurance, or your insurance is going to triple or go up five times. Two months is a very short period of time, and waiting 9 months or a year and a half for somebody to figure out a new system is not good. A MAP has worked. For some people, we've had a lot of help from the MAP. It's not a bad idea. But to wait until the MAP is finished and then have to start the GUAL doesn't make any sense. There's no reason those two processes could not have been started at the same time. We could have been getting some relief right as we're speaking today. There are, as Mr. Chandler said, a number of other bills that you're going to hear. One of the bills that we do not support is one that's put in by Senator Atkinson saying that we should eliminate the insurance requirement. Our folks think that responsible business people need to be insured, and we do not want to compete with some folks who decide not to get insured. We think everyone ought to have insurance. We don't support that bill. We do want to have that insurance affordable. I know a whole lot less than Mr. Chandler knows about insurance. But I do want to say, and I understand he doesn't know a lot. But I do want to say that there is somebody in this building who does understand a lot about insurance. Mr. Ario is a person I think you understand because he is a consumer representative. He represents the interests of the people of the state. So he's got a combination of not having a financial interest in what the decision is made, and he has a knowledge of the industry and the issues. And I would hope that you would listen to his suggestions. There may be some details that need to be worked out at defining what affordability is, for example, but I would have him, certainly don't put me on a work group, I'm not going to be helpful, but I do want to let you know that there is a problem, and it's not something that if we just slowly take our time, it'll eventually take care of itself. Thank you.
And I'll ask for a few closing comments by the committee members here before the other committee comes in. But just as some direction, and Ms. Van Winkle will be contacting folks because I think this issue needs to be addressed. There's also been some comments that were made, you know, regarding the adjudication process and why that has fueled some of these costs. And I think that's part of this discussion. You know, I think that's all part of it. And some specific questions, especially if we do run out of time here for your closing comments, that you have for some of these folks. I know I do. I want to get them to Teresa to address. For example, Mr. Ariel, I am curious about Section 10 that's been brought up. I'm interested in some data, specific data. Mr. Chandler, about you say people go out of business. I like anecdotes, but I also like real facts. And I think those types of things would be helpful and see what we can do. Now, closing comments by the or questions by the committee.
Sure, may I add just one thing? I think you ought to take a look at the insurance policies you're putting put out now. At the same time that we're being told that the reason for these insurance rates is because of EFIS, it's because of mold, it's because of condominium claims.
Well, look at that. Mr. Kapori, I want Mr. Senator Starr, I think, had a question. Did you have one, Senator Starr?
Well, I have a whole lot of comments. And I'm just frustrated that we don't have any time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I'm a former contractor whose liability was canceled. The insurer no longer offered the line. And so I went to shop to find some new insurance, and my premium was going to triple in order for me to stay in business. So I understand the contractor side of this. I'm not convinced that this is the solution to the problem. And as both of our guests here talked, sure, we could fill the capital full of contractors who have had problems. And I'm still not convinced that this is the solution to that particular problem. I think that there are a lot of other issues that we have to solve here. And, you know, Mr. Chandler said it himself. He's not an expert in insurance. I just think we need to make sure that we have good data as we move forward on this. I don't want to do anything. I get a letter from an insurance agency saying that if we do this, that you know they're going to look at doing business in other states. Are we going to create the problem, a worse problem, by moving with this so-called solution or something else? So I just think we need to be really careful that we don't do more damage here than good. I guess I'm just urging caution, and I understand firsthand the issue that contractors specifically have faced in this state, and I just think we need to be real careful.
Good point, Senator Montesac.
If we get the data, I want to make sure that it's good data, all right, and I think insurance companies should come up, but I'd also like if there's any kind of information from the home builders, it'd be good to get their data, too.
Senator Decker, you have a question?
Well, just one thing that Ms. Monroe said that I think Mr. Chandler would want to answer at some point in this debate is that this does not address the root causes of what lies underneath. And to me, that's something that is an interesting answer that we don't have time for right now. But in some ways, it asks your industry and your folks. It's a question to the practices, but it's also a question of what also underlies whether it's litigation or other costs. And I would not leave out practices that are within the construction industry that I simply don't know about, but they're obviously alluding to.
That's a good point. A couple things as we close. Again, this will be they'll be coming back, and we do have, as has been mentioned, and I think you folks know, we have a number of other bills in this committee that deal with this overall issue of cost and affordability and impacts. And so we're going to try to put a dustpan around some of these things and see where some of these things intersect. If you have questions about these particular questions that have been raised in this committee, you know, please get them to Ms. Van Winkle, Senator Deckert, Senator Starr. Senator Decker, Senator Starr. Please, if you have specific questions about some of the issues that were brought up here, get them to Ms. Van Winkle so we can have them prepared when we bring this back with these other bills that deal with this overall issue. I am very interested in about, just put your finger down, please. I am very, very interested in finding out about the Oregon experience. I mean, I think it is, and I'd like to, some of our insurance people in the audience, to, we talked about how we don't like to, you know, unless we already have to, we don't like to have to spread, you know, risk when we have these programs with the state. But certainly when we talk about the rates for contractors and others, the rates are high because they have spread the risk of people doing business in Oregon because of losses elsewhere. I mean, so it works the other way and makes us pay. And it would be curious to see, you know, from the insurance department's data, Mr. Ariel, you know, kind of what that experience has been based on what has been submitted to you. And I do think that, as Mr. Starr, Senator Starr has pointed out, is extremely important, and it's, and I realize how difficult these issues are, but we are both the Business and Economic Development Committee. And as we talk about business, we want to make sure that, you know, business is in business, and that means the insurance folks as well. But it's also economic development, and we don't want contractors leaving the state anymore. We want insurance companies leaving the state because they can't afford to do business here. So there's got to be a nexus here, and as Senator Starr pointed out, this may not be exactly what that is, but I don't think that's an excuse for us not to try and do what we can. So thank you very much, and I'm sorry we didn't get to the other bill. We will get there, and with that, the committee is adjourned.